Hi, welcome to Civic's Change Agent Chat, episode 16. During these chats, we speak with change agents who are working to create a better healthcare system for us all. I'm Stephanie Spriggs with the Center for Improving Value in Healthcare, or as we like to call it, Civic. In this chat, Kari Degernis, Civic's Director of Healthcare Programs, is speaking with Kim Mooney, the founder of Practically Dying. Practically Dying is an end-of-life educational and support resource organization whose mission is to help people remember how to engage birth, life, and death as opportunities to live without hesitation and die without regret. During this chat, we'll learn the importance of engaging with death as a part of life and the different opportunities around Colorado to take the first step. We recorded this chat in March 2019. Thanks for listening and enjoy the chat.
Well, thank you all for tuning into our Change Agent Chat. I'm Kari Degernis, the Director of Healthcare Programs here at Civic. Today, we're featuring Kim Mooney, the founder of Practically Dying. Kim, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
And I would love to just start off by having you introduce yourself and telling us what a thanatologist is.
So I have been in end-of-life care for 26 years. I started with hospice when we were a wee industry, way before we started dealing with partnering with the medical system. You know, we were this little weird thing off to the corner that where people got dropped off when they were dying. That's what we were. That was 26 years ago. And I got to grow with the industry. And then about 3 years ago, I broke away from hospice and started my own company. And one of the things I did do a long time ago was get a certification in thanatology. And you did pronounce it right. Many people don't. I have on my website a number of little clips of people trying to pronounce it because it's such a funny word. It's a good conversation starter. But thanatology is the study of death and dying and grief in all of its aspects. So social, psychosocial, physical, you know, concrete points of it. It's just a very broad study, and people don't get it. So I'm at a party and someone says, "You're a thanatologist, what does that mean?" And someone else entered, "Well, wait a minute, that means she works with dead things." And I said, "No, that's a forensic pathologist," and I'm a lot more fun at the party than they are. So trying to get people to understand anything about death besides the word death has been really, they're all good conversations opener, but pretty much what I am is an educator. And the Association for Death Education and Counseling, where I got my certification, is probably the biggest and the most well-known international association for all things dying, death, and grief. So these are practitioners who come, and clinicians, and morticians, and therapists, and the people who do the research, and the people who write the books, and, you know, police departments. Everybody who's got anything to do with death, dying, or grief comes, and we get together, and we not only learn from each other how to be on the ground with death, but there are really important issues that go on behind the scenes that a lot of people don't know about. Like a couple of years ago, there was a lot of controversy about whether or not what we call complicated grief should be part of the DSM-5 or not. Now, in real life, what that means is, do we want to put grief back into a medical system that medicalizes it to be able to give it a diagnosis? And that's really important for some people who need medical attention, who have clinical depression. But also, we're really trying to take death and grief not only out of the closet, but take them out of that medicalized mindset and let them be experienced and seen for as normal human experiences. So things like that go on a lot that the public doesn't know about, that for thanatologists, it's really important to understand how death and dying are being treated in the culture as well as what the experience is.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So it's much broader than what I even had a picture of, so that's fantastic. And you mentioned you started your own company, which is Practically Dying. Can you tell us about how and why you started that and what kind of goals you have for your organization through the work that you do?
Sure. I was with hospice for 22 years, and it's fabulous work. But after becoming a thanatologist, really looking at all of those different aspects that were not covered by hospice, which, you know, is great for expected deaths and people who are dealing with, you know, very particular kinds of processes, I realized how much more there was that wasn't being addressed. And I was very lucky because I came into the industry at a time when we could do just about anything we wanted, as long as we were supporting the community. So I also helped develop one of the first interagency crisis intervention teams, the first one in Boulder County. So I was down at Columbine, not doing grief counseling. We were doing crisis intervention. And I also got to work a lot with different groups in the community. And so I really wanted to be able to do more than just hospice. And I don't say that lightly. I did not know what it was going to turn out to be, but I have worked with clients who are using medical aid in dying. I'm involved with a couple of bioethics committees. I was involved with the rollout of the medical orders for scope of treatment. You know, I was able to take a lot of the experience, like developing bereavement programs or training grief group facilitators, adjunct faculty at universities. I've been able to roll all that into what's almost hard to describe, because I just say to people, if you want to deal with, if you're dealing with something unpopular and scary, just come and talk to me and I'll tell you what I know. A little bit too much, a little bit of everything. It's been, you know, really lovely. So, so what I do now, I do a lot of speaking and teaching about the things I mentioned above, and workshops on caregiving, and a lot on advanced care planning and grief support, because I believe, honestly, that underneath all of this, if you can't face and recognize and deal with grief, you can't do any of the rest of the work. So that's really, rather than being a real bummer, it's the underpinnings to all of the work that we're doing, any of us in advanced illness or, you know, dying or palliative care, anything, is the ability to understand the nature of grief and how you work with that and with people throughout the whole thing, or there's no healthy way to do it. I do work with people who are dying. I write curricula for end-of-life projects. I've worked with medical groups on how to open conversations with their patients. I've had a little radio and TV show, basically both focused on death. I've consulted with companies on working with grief in the workplace, and just got back from California working with a county mental health agency on how to get their staff, who are all in their early 20s, more comfortable dealing with dying clients. And in the middle of it, here's the most fun part, I've been involved with groups that get to create these incredible events. We had a group called Conversations on Death, and for 3 years, we put on an all-day seminar, and it sold out and got bigger every year. And we did sessions on spirituality and dying and death traditions around the world, and had a couple of doctors come in and talk about what happens to your brain when it's dying. So there's so much. There's so much to learn that it's fascinating. It's not scary. It's all very fascinating.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting, because we know that dying is inevitable. That's something that we know that everyone is going to experience at some point, and we're also going to experience loss in our lifetimes as well. But a lot of us are scared to talk about it and are truly afraid of death. And so I'm sure through that work, you do a lot to help that perspective and work through those situations. But how do you get people to actually open up and talk about it and sort of take the fear out of the word death and dying?
Great question. The biggest one in the whole country right now. I think I would say it, well, first of all, to understand, as what I've said before, is that there's so many different aspects to death. And there are three ways to get people opened up, at least initially. One is that I find that there are a lot more people who are ignorant of it than people who are really afraid to talk about it. Nobody's ever given them an opportunity. So if you can get in at the right place at the right time, and the first thing I would say is that we do kind of say, we see death as this giant monolith. And so there's a line we don't cross, and it's a big black rock, and it's just death. So we want to break that apart. And even knowing that that can be broken apart is a piece of the education. So the continuum that my company works on is very broad, and it starts at what I would call the lightest touch. So you may or may not have heard of death cafes. Have you heard of death cafes?
Yep, I've heard of those.
So there are about, 1,700 around the world, and all you do in them is sit and talk to each other. And so people come in who've never talked about death. They don't have to. You don't have to open your mouth, but you can sit and listen to people. and get up and leave. No responsibility, no liability. And people come and they leave and they go, oh my God, I didn't realize that you could laugh. I didn't realize that there were things that were interesting, you know, just purely interesting. Yeah. And then you move a little farther along the continuum and you have things like death over dinner, where you invite people over to your house. This is a little more of a commitment because you ask them to bring a couple of questions that they're going to answer about death. And then you can move into things like the conversations on death, where there are a lot of topics and it's really interesting. And then you get to that pivot point where all of a sudden it starts to be about you. And that's where people start getting scared. They're fascinated by the traditions around the world because we're not talking to them about their own lives. So in that pivot point, there are really good tools like the Conversation Project that they're a little bit about you, but they're not terrifying. They're not asking you about your body. They're things like, you know, how empowered do you want to be? Do you want to know everything? Would you prefer, you know, not to know everything and let your family take care of it? How much do you want your doctor involved? Really just light conversation. And then when you move farther along the continuum, then you start to ask the questions, hopefully ahead of time. Okay, let's talk about what you might want when and if. And then when you really get on at the very end of the continuum, that's when people are down to the wire and they're asking questions. And, you know, we're hoping that more people come to death cafes and move through that continuum rather than start their work and their thinking at the very end. So I've worked on all those places in the continuum, and you're really looking for where each person wants to enter it. That's the thing. Where can you get somebody interested before they're scared? So I have it's great. One of the presentations I do is called Life and Death Can't Have One Without the Other. And it's pretty light, good topics, but really pretty light. And one of the things I bring up is that in Bhutan, they say that they have one of the highest, happiest quotients in the world. They also say that one of their cultural practices is to think about death 5 times a day. And during this talk, I asked them whether or not their first goldfish was buried in the backyard or flushed down the toilet.
Okay.
I have them raise their hands, backyard or toilet. I ask them what it's like to wrinkle, to get older skin. We talk about the Toraja tribe in the Philippines that carve effigies of their loved ones, and then they put them in these galleries around the village, so you always have grandpa staring down at you. And we just go with whatever comes up. And at the end of the hour, I say, do you realize that you have just talked about death 5 times? People are surprised. So things like that, where you're not just drilling down and saying, okay, what do you want if you can't breathe? That whole fan, I think, is really important. The other thing is humor. I think that presentations around death and talking about death does not have to be morbid. I think people really get fascinated. You know, when you let them start to tell stories about, you know, grandpa's ashes flying out into the wind and landing on everybody and people laughing because they all knew grandpa didn't want to leave, or, you know, some of the things, that they're just funny things. So I think that humor is a huge part of this. As George Bernard Shaw said, life does not cease to be funny when people die any more than it ceases to be serious when people laugh. And the third thing then is to get people to tell stories, because that is how everything's going to change. We can listen to the experts, we can go to conferences, we can read, but we learn in personal and fascinating ways what happened to another person. And that sets differently in us. Humans have told stories since the beginning of time. So, you know, when we hear about each other's stories, it's a softer way to lose our fear. And physicians change their perceptions when patients tell them what's happening or what happened because of their interactions. You know, those are the impacts. Those make a point. So one thing I'll tell you, Mary Labiak, who was a ED of the Hospice of the Florida Suncoast years and years ago, like 20 years ago, wrote a paper called The Experience Model, moving discussions at end of life from the disease-based model to a palliative care-based model. And one of the things we did that was really cool was we would sit in an IDT meeting in a hospice, and an IDT meeting is where the whole staff that's involved in that care with the doctors sit down and talk about where the patient is that week. What is the current status? And usually it starts out with a very medical piece and then it kind of goes into what's next. But what she said was, let's stand up on two legs. So she had the physician stand up and say, here's what's going on medically with this person. And then she had the social worker stand up right next to him and say, and here's how the family's doing. And here's what the patient and I are doing. So she created this full-bodied story about what was happening to a person who was dying. And those kinds of things are, I think, what's going to change everything.
Wow. Yeah, I don't think people realize how complex it is and how many things there are that go into this process. And I like your point on bringing in humor, because we often brought that in to care settings. And humor is okay in the dying process. And in fact, it's actually really beneficial to reflect back and think about the enjoyments and just have some humor built in, because it allows that grief process to ease up a little bit. So very interesting.
Exactly.
Well, you've touched on a couple of some of the impacts that you're making with how you're approaching your work, but what is the biggest impact that you want to make on society through what you do?
I don't think anybody should get older or sicker or die terrified of what's going to happen to them. You know, we could be frightened or sorry or sad, but we shouldn't be terrified. I don't think that's natural. I think that's a product of our acculturation. I think it's not historically been our life situation, our human situation, but we are today terrified and paralyzed by it. And we don't have to accept dying with complete peace. You know, it doesn't have to be, you know, a soft room with light coming from the bed, but we do have to get used to it. We do have to get familiar with it so we can at least quit pretending it's not happening. I would love to be able to impact that part of our society, get rid of the terror so that we can live with it. We're all going to be dealing with this, clearly. But if we could learn to live with it when we're not the ones dealing with it, then we would have a lot more bandwidth for other people. Because we can say dying is a sacred experience, we can say dying is normal, but when you're in the middle of going through it or you're losing someone, it is the most horrible thing in the world. Mm-hmm. And so what we want is we want to be strong enough to take care of those people and see their stories so that when it's our turn, other people can care for us, but we get it in our gut. And I would love to be able to help that happen.
Wow. That's a hard thing to transition from. That's a big impact, but I think you're spot on. That's fascinating. So what do you think that community members and other healthcare organizations, what are you asking of them to maybe help get you to that goal and help your work?
You know, I would like them to understand kind of what we've been talking about, that there are many more awarenesses and conversations to be had other than the direct discussions about your health goals or your advanced care planning. I'd like them to be able to talk about grandpa's ashes, because we need those formal conversations. We really need them. We need them earlier and we need them with more skill, but they are a tough place for a lot of people to start. So if we individually and organizationally could find ways to relate to all this outside of thinking in terms of, quote, best patient outcomes, because that's still about them. So I guess what I'm saying is we need to find our own experience in this. So medical groups that haven't encouraged their own employees to sit down and talk about even appointing a healthcare agent, not forcing them to do it, but to consider it as a core part of their professional education. They can't offer people the same patient-centered care if they haven't done their own exploration. So I would encourage everybody, and I help people do this because it's fun for me. But you know, the clinicians and even the administrators and colleges who have the hardest time supporting other people or knowing how to take the fear out of other people's experiences, 85% of the time, I think the primary driver is that they haven't done their own work. They haven't looked into their own loss history. They haven't been able to take it on their own. And I don't think you can talk to people about death and dying unless you're open to it. And most of us have had losses, and we there's a lot of the top administration in almost every organization that hasn't, that won't deal with it because of their own history. So I'd like to see people take more of that on in kind of what I'm saying, non-threatening ways, but, you know, willing to take a deep breath and stay with it until they see that they're making a change.
Wonderful. Well, Kim, this has been an amazing chat, and thank you so much for all the work that you're doing, because this is so critical, and I even took a lot away from today's chat, so I hope folks listening in also did as well. Is there anything else that you would like to share before we conclude today?
Well, yes, actually, it's very exciting. I am writing a book about this spectrum. It's a light touch, but I can make serious topics light, which is a huge gift for what I'm doing. And the chapters are things like, when is dead dead? Does this skeleton make my butt look big? How can I die well if you won't let me wrinkle? Dealing with aging and losses and how you do let go of the fear of dying and get to be at least comfortable with it. So anybody who's interested in anything I'm doing and the book can get on my mailing list off my website. But, you know, my final message, I think, would be that doing this for all this time, facing death does not make you more fearful. It actually makes you bold. You don't waste time, and you aren't careless with people anymore. It's the greatest gift that we can have, is understanding our mortality. So in some ways, I think I have the most interesting and most rewarding work in the world, and I am fun at parties.
Well, good. Well, thank you so much, and thank you to those who tuned in. We appreciate everyone, you taking the time to speak with us, and then the folks on the phone, thank you so much for listening. And we will conclude.
All right. Thank you for inviting me.